we are very happy to have Joanne Trow, who is going to review When Everything Changed, The Amazing Journey of American Women from 1960 to the Present by Gail Collins. And to introduce Joanne is Jean Peters.
Right now, there's a coffee there. Hello. I'm Jean Peters, and it is my pleasure and honor to introduce today's reviewer, my colleague and friend, Joanne Trow, Vice President Emeritus for Student Affairs at OSU. I think I earned the honor because I'm one of the relatively small group of women faculty who were at OSU when she arrived. I've been around a long time. We were still mostly in female-designated categories like student services and home economics in a mostly very male bastion, let me tell you. Gail Collins, Joanne, and others of us I can see here today experienced those firsts that are in the title, the first for American women on this amazingly rapid journey of change during the past 50 or 60 years. And I'm guaranteeing that a lot of us could tell some eye-rolling stories about it. Joanne is a remarkable observer with a phenomenal memory, which frequently rescues those of us who share her earlier morning exercise class, and it makes her ideal for this review. She graduated from Denison University and completed graduate degrees at Indiana and Michigan State Universities. And the then Dr. Trow joined the student affairs staff at OSU in 1965 and went on to become the last dean of women and the first female vice president. Can you imagine a woman as a university vice president? That was indeed a journey of change. Besides her notable contributions to the OSU administration and the field of student services and affairs during her 30 years of service and her continuing support today of OSU activities like music and theater and sports, she is a dyed-in-the-wool beaver, tried and true. She's also participated and led so many Corvallis community enterprises and boards, like League of Women Voters, OSU Folk Club and Thrift Shop, OSURA, which is the Retirees Association. We finally got her retired so she could take over on leadership there. 509J Public Schools Foundation, Corvallis Parks and Rec, Old Mill School, and that's just to name a few. She and husband, Senator Cliff, have been participants and agents for many of the changes depicted in today's book on the local scene and in the state of Oregon. So it's truly a great pleasure to introduce Joanne.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much, Jean. I'm looking around here and I see so many people who I'm sure have read this book. But what a read this book was. And I am so pleased that I was asked to review this book because it does cover a period in our history that in which I was very involved professionally and a period that still resonates with many in my and your generations. And since this is Women's History Month, in case you didn't know, and I'm sure a lot of you found yesterday with all of the information that was on television and radio, yesterday was the 100th anniversary of International Women's Day. So I hope that looking around the room, and as Jean noted, we all have lots of stories to share, that we have time before we leave to share experiences and memories of this period. But how many of you have read this book? Well, not as many as I would have thought. Or have you read the earlier one, which the library does have, but it's not on the shelf back there, called her earlier one, called America's Women, 400 Years of Dolls, Drudges, Helpmates, and Heroines, which took the history of American women for the first 400 years up to 1960. So for those of you who have read this book, you could identify with many of the examples and situations that Colin describes. But let's see what she had to say. But first, who is Gail Collins? She currently serves as the op-ed columnist for the New York Times and previously had been the first woman editorial page editor for the Times. She was born in 1945 in a little town on Lake Erie in the far northeast corner of Ohio. Her family at some point moved to the southern part of the state. Collins' mother encouraged Gail's early interest and talent in journalism and even sent a journal that Gail kept as a young girl to a paper to be published. Her degrees are a BA at Marquette in 1967 in journalism and an MA in government from UMass Amherst in 1970. Gail got involved for a number of years in political reporting in Connecticut and in New York and joined the Times in 1995 at the age of 50. She's written other books, notably the one I just mentioned, as well as one with her husband, and her Facebook page tells us, and she is on Facebook, that she likes, quote, traveling with my husband Dan and gardening, but if left to my own devices, will happily watch Buffy the Vampire Slayer reruns and play computer solitaire forever. Now, to the book. Collins' objective in writing this book was, it aims to tell the story of what happened to American women since 1960 by combining the public drama of the era with the memories of regular women who lived through it all. To get to the second part, to the memories of women, my team of interviewers and I sat down with more than 100 women from around the country, ranging in age from the late 80s to the early 20s, who generously agreed to talk with us about their lives. She organized the narrative primarily by decade, giving real-life examples with lots of quotes. Her references at the back are thorough and worthy of a good term paper. I was a little disappointed in the lack of geographic diversity and distribution of the interviews, but basically it was pretty well balanced. And none of the examples or stories involved her own experiences, which I thought was kind of interesting. There are a few photographs in the middle of the book, and unfortunately, I did not think they were very representative. I think more care could have been taken in their selection. But so what do others have to say about her book? The reviews of the book have been overwhelmingly positive, almost unanimous in their praise. They cite the content of the book. It's well written. Her entertaining writing, the humor, was a balanced approach and was very well researched and documented. Individual reactions as well as professional reviewers at the Washington Post, the New York Times, San Francisco Chronicle, Kirkus, were all that an author could want. The very few negative reviews were, believe it or not, mainly from men. These, as well as a couple of women commentators, voiced their concern that the last few chapters were too political in their outlook and that the book overall did not give stay-at-home women credit. On the other hand, there were several of the positive comments who thought that the stay-at-home women were treated quite fairly and not denigrated. And I would agree that while Collins did not spend a lot of time in that area, she did treat it fairly. You'll have to read the book for yourself to decide if this is of interest to you. Now, in the book, Collins traces the movement through each decade, citing examples from real life and literature. She uses examples of real life skillfully to illustrate the temper of the times, even though at times her generalizations can seem a bit ambiguous. Politics play a big part of the movement through the years, and she treats that with an even hand. Now, with the post-war boom, with the post-war boom and in the 1960s came the labor-saving devices for the home, new interests in education for women, and such books as the famous Feminine Mystique by Betty Friedan, which ignited ideas, desires, and questions. And Collins summarizes that decade thusly. Many of the young, and so there it was. The post-war economy created a demand for women workers, and the post-industrial economy created jobs that they were particularly suited to fill. The soaring expectations of the post-war boom, followed by the decline in men's paychecks in the 70s, made wives' participation in the workforce almost a requisite for middle-class life. The birth control pill gave young women confidence that they could pursue a career without interruption by pregnancy. The civil rights movement, of which I'll have a little bit more to say in a minute, made women conscious of the ways that they had been treated like second-class citizens and made them determined that their own status was one of the things that they were going to change. By the end of the 60s, life for women was not at all like it is today. Most women in college, those who went to college, majored in the liberal arts, education, home economics. An article in this weekend's newspaper, the Gazette Time, featuring two women forestry students, twins from Philomath, participating in the annual College of Forestry Spring Thaw Activity Day, coupled with the fact that this presentation today brought back an experience I had in the fall of 1966. I had just assumed the role of Dean of Women, and Dean McCulloch, then Dean of the School of Forestry, called at the office to see me. We exchanged pleasantries as he welcomed me to the campus. I'd already been there a year. And we chatted. Then he proceeded to cheerfully assure me that I would never have to worry about any of his students. And why? Quote, "Because," he said, "we don't have women in the School of Forestry." And it wasn't until a number of years later that there were any. As for athletics, in the 60s, what women's sports there were probably intramural or NAIA. Teams traveled long distances in vans, stayed in cramped motels, and scholarships were unheard of. Dress, pants outfits were not appropriate except for picnics and gardening. Women had a hard time getting credit on their own or buying a house. Women in television and radio were typified by June Cleaver, Gracie Allen, and Ozzie and Harriet. At OSU, women faculty were in education, home economics, women's physical education, liberal arts, and maybe one or two in pharmacy and agriculture, and none in engineering and forestry. Now, of particular interest in this book were parts of chapters on the 60s and the 70s, and I found them very informative and even learned something new. There's a long chapter on civil rights that emphasizes the significant role that this movement played in getting the women's movement started. Many of the major figures in the civil rights struggle were women who have never been adequately recognized, women like Marion Wright Edelman, Leonora Tate Magabane, Ella Baker, whom SNCC leaders called, quote, our Gandhi, Diane Nash, Daisy Bates, Dorothy Height, Eunita Blackwell, Fannie Lou Hamer, Ruby Doris, and many more. It's worth reading this book for the information and inspiration found in that chapter alone. For instance, the whole story of Rosa Parks is much more complex than the oft-told tale of women weary from work who did not want to move, of a woman weary from work who did not want to move to another seat on the segregated bus. Rosa Parks had been an active worker for change and the rights of African Americans in the South for years before this famous incident. And what is even more distressing and illustrative of the way that women were treated in general by the men in the civil rights movement was that neither she nor any of the other active women were allowed at Martin Luther King's Washington March in 1963 to speak, and could do no more than sit at the side of the long line of people on the stage. There were no women included in the meeting that followed with JFK later. Yet they were a major influence in what happened in that movement and was an inspiration for women in what they could do. Collins summarizes the relationship of the civil rights movements and the rise of the of the women's movement thusly. Fighting slavery had been the first moral issue so grave that the housebound middle-class Victorian matrons felt compelled to go into the outside world and engage in politics. It was, as the sociologist Alice Rossi said, the only instance, this is the women's movement, in which people being discriminated against lived in much more intimate association with the enemy than with the other members of their own group. And I have met Alice Rossi, and if you have never read any of her publications, she's retired now from Harvard, but she is an excellent sociologist in women's issues. Women's interests were bound up with those of their fathers, husbands, brothers, and sons in every aspect of their lives. It was difficult for them to mount the kind of clear-cut fight that racial and ethnic minorities were able to make against an establishment that discriminated against them. It was probably why the women's movement always tended to ride on the wake of other fights for justice, such as abolition. The early women's rights movement that grew out of those anti-slavery actions and into the 20th century and the suffrage movement went along with the progressive era, when the nation was focused on the evils of poverty and unbridled capitalism. And in the 1960s, women's greatest legislative victory was the amendment tacked on to the Civil Rights Act of 1964, Title VII, which prohibited job discrimination against women. Another lengthy examination in this book was the kind of conflicts that arose at the beginning of the women's movement between and among various groups, particularly the strong feminist groups, the radical groups, the bra burners, the outspoken angry women, and the more traditional organizations like ERA supporters, sympathetic politicians, emerging activists of AAUW, and others. The discussion of the drive to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment, how it almost became a reality, and then came the resulting crushing defeat, leaves one wondering what might happen today if it were to come up again, and it looks like it might. On the Sunday TV program, just to the contrary, this past Sunday, note was made that Representative Carolyn Maloney from New York and Senator Robert Menendez will introduce the Equal Rights Amendment again, this congressional session, with the intent to try to overcome the ideas such as those expressed by Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, who said that the 14th Amendment does not apply to women. That's the one that gave the vote to the... And the discussion on Sunday among five women, some progressive, some conservative, was a mixed bag of why this should or should not pass, with no little ambivalence about why it was not necessary. Some of the comments in opposition were the same as the arguments made in the 70s, so the battle is not over. Collins makes several points about the defeat of the ERA in the 1970s, including the influence of Phyllis Schlafly, who I imagine many of you have heard of. And one of the things that she notes is that Schlafly probably could not have achieved the status and the position that she did within the women's movement and within the Republican Party if it had not been for the feminist movement that allowed her to move ahead with her education and to do what she wanted to do. But the Schlafly and those groups of people she pulled together did a very effective job of turning people against the ERA with the promulgation of myths and false assumptions of what it meant. In addition, there was the economic recession, the oil crisis of the 70s, all proved to be distractions that took the steam out of that movement. The chapters in the 1970s tell the stirring story of the increased political influence of women in the Congress and state houses all over the country. Women like Edith Green of Oregon, Martha Griffiths, Michigan, Patsy Mink of Hawaii, all of whom sponsored Title IX legislation. Ella Grasso of Connecticut, Bella Abzug and Geraldine Ferraro of New York, Barbara Jordan of Texas, Madeline Coonan of Vermont, and Wilma Mankiller of Oklahoma are just a few of the women who made great inroads. Commissions on the status of women were established across the country and in Oregon, and began to examine the role of women and how to increase opportunities for women. Title IX, which banned discrimination on the basis of sex in schools that receive federal funds, passed in 1972. And it had more of an impact for women than educators and politicians originally thought. Most immediately, it was applied to admissions in professional programs, to academic opportunities and hiring standards. But in 1974, the agency charged with writing the regulations to implement the law and Title IX said that it required schools to give women students comparable athletic opportunities. And that regulation concerning athletics continues to resonate in educational institutions across the country. And to some, that's all the Title IX is about, but it really is much more. But at that time, there were even some women's organizations at educational institutions who were at first unwilling to agree to accept men into their organizations. And that happened here at OSU. But that was part of the deal, because they feared that they would be taken over by the men. Well, I personally know that this did not happen in a number of national student organizations where men joined what had been traditionally women's organizations, where it quickly became apparent that the groups that had been only women were better organized, had more secure and finances and more money salted away, and were better run than some of what had been comparable men's only organizations. The women's groups which have become have thrived and had continued to survive. And in Oregon in the 1970s, there also was a great political awakening. An informative and inspiring article, She Flies on Her Own Wings, which is also the motto of the state of Oregon, by the way, describes the work of 11 women legislators in 1973 session of the Oregon Legislative Assembly who broke barriers and achieved women's interests like there had never been before. And one of the most significant was House Bill 2116, which banned discrimination based on sex and marital status in Oregon. You may recognize some of their names: Betty Roberts, Norma Paulus, Mary Reike, Vera Katz, Nancy Fadley, and more. And in addition, several women's organizations in Oregon, the Equal Rights Alliance, Women's Caucus of the Legislature, Oregon Women's Political Caucus, and others came into prominence during the early 1970s. In the 1973 legislative session, through the collaborative efforts of women legislators, activists, and allies from the men from both parties, a feminist agenda advanced earlier and more effectively than in other states. The result was that women's lives changed measurably and rapidly, although I would add that it is still necessary to champion unresolved issues in the current legislature. The article that I referred to appears in the spring 2010 issue of the Oregon Historical Quarterly if you want to read more. And while we're talking about Oregon, this small paperback called Images of Oregon Women give a number of vignettes of active women in Oregon in the 1970s and the 1980s. And some of you, I'm sure, will recognize many of the people names in this volume. Another issue, a major issue that held great promise in the 1970s, was the availability of childcare for working parents. And in the early 70s, a bipartisan group of U.S. senators and representatives passed legislation that would make child care available to every family that wanted it. And I will say that Collins emphasizes the issues of child care and the lack of adequate child care in almost every one of the decades that she discusses. She tells us that Walter Mondale and John Bradamus, Democrats, were the main sponsors, but the bill had strong Republican support as well. It was a wonderful bill. Let me read to you what it said. The legislation aimed at establishing early education programs in every community in the country, as well as after-school care for older children. The federal government would set standards, provide support services such as meals, medical and dental checkups, and counseling. There was money to train staff and acquire buildings. The services would be free for lower-income people, and most middle-class families would qualify for at least subsidized tuition. Households whose income was in the top 25% would be charged the full fee. No families were required to participate, but everyone would be eligible. There was barely any opposition, but then President Nixon vetoed the Comprehensive Child Development Act, claiming it was a communal approach to child rearing. It would undermine the family-centered approach and diminish parental authority and involvement. Collins includes an extended discussion of the events that followed the veto, which was largely engineered by Pat Buchanan and Howard Phillips, and concludes that, quote, although Congress would keep fiddling with preschool programs to help poor children, there was never another serious attempt to create a national answer to the problem of who took care of the kids in an economy that now depended on women to work. Overall, Collins characterizes the 1970s in the title of that chapter on the decade as "You're Going to Make It After All." So look back on a decade as fraught with changes in the 70s, and you will pick your own vision. Best of times, worst of times. Women who wanted to work often found it easier to get a job than men did. But the jobs they found still tended to pay much less. It was easier for them to end unsatisfactory marriages, but sometimes harder to get spousal support. It was more difficult to keep life in balance, but more possible to shoot for the stars. She characterizes the 1980s as having it all. A study prepared for the President's Advisory Committee for Women found that most Americans felt, or at least said, it would be fine for them if their doctor, lawyer, major, or boss was a female. The country got used to the idea that women would not only make money to help support the family, but also have serious careers. It was perhaps the decade in which women were most optimistic about the possibility of merging husband, children, and major league jobs. And there were additional changes in television programming, in dress standards, the advent of the pantsuit, and how I think most of us remember the lengthy discussions in the office at the school about when it was appropriate for women staff to wear pantsuits to work. But there were still the issues of childcare, wage equality, and other concerns. However, in the 1990s, the first generation of American women who had not been told that their only place was in the home had come of age. Collins portrays a certain ambivalence about the movement and titles that chapter "Settling for Less." It was, in one way, exactly what their elders had been hoping for. American women who had grown up confident that they were entitled to all the educational and career opportunities that boys got, who played sports in school and with as fierce a competitive spirit, and who expected to have success and love and adventure in equal measure. All that was a point of pride for the older generation. But there was also the disappointment of realizing that the younger women took it all for granted. Things I fought for are now considered quaint, novelist Erica Jong told Time. They say we don't need feminism anymore. They don't understand graduating magna cum laude from Harvard and then being told to go into the typing pool. And so that brings us then to the new millennium, in which Collins is much more optimistic, to a point. She's talking in this chapter about comments that Betty Friedan was making toward the end of her life. She died, Betty Friedan died in 2006 at the age of 85, and that in which she said that there's a lot of silly talk that the women's movement is dead. Well, it's not dead. It's alive in society, she wrote. The women look at themselves. The way other people look at women is certainly different, completely different than it was 30 years ago. And Collins comments, she was right in many counts. By the beginning of the new century, women were claiming almost half the seats in the nation's medical and law schools. They dominated some fields that used to be almost exclusively male, such as pharmacy and veterinary medicine. Although I will say, some of the work that I've done in the history of women at OSU indicates there were women in the College of Pharmacy almost from the very beginning, which was very interesting. Although vet medicine, now is almost all women. 40% of the new dental school graduates were women. And so there were gains as well for women in the business world, the armed forces, education, politics. She does conclude the final chapter with a discussion of Hillary and Sarah both. Even in the small, exclusive world of symphony music, where they had traditionally been a rarity, women occupied more than a third of the chairs in top orchestra. Thanks in part to a policy of blind auditions that kept judges in the dark about the sex of the competitors. This week's issue of Newsweek, if any of you have seen it, just came, lists the names and accomplishments of 150 women from around the world who've made a difference. And there's quite a long article about Hillary Clinton and the work that she's done in terms of helping women around the world to gain additional status and education and places that make a difference. But this fact that there are 150 women from around the world, and there are a number, of course, in the United States that are listed as well that make a difference, I think is important. So times are continuing to change, not only in the United States, but around the world. In each of these decades, Collins cites the way that women are portrayed on television, in the on-again, off-again gains in childcare legislation, the place of women in politics, the ongoing fight for women's health initiatives and reproductive rights, and wage equality, standards and expectations of how women should dress, opportunities for careers and exciting jobs, and relationship to society as a whole. And so many of these issues are still with us today as we strive for adequate child care, preservation of women's reproductive rights, wage equality. A report just last week indicated that women's pay was still about 77% of men's, but the wage gap for younger women was about 89%. And there still is need in many areas for recognition of women's contributions. So for each decade that Collins describes, I, and I imagine each of you, can recall experiences, encounters, discussions. I remember dozens of examples from incidents from the OSU and from Corvallis. One of Collins' stories involves a hairdresser who was finally able to purchase a home even though there had earlier been a ban on single women purchasing homes. There was a discrimination in lending. But one of her clients was strangely cold to her because Peterson, the hairdresser, had not told the client she had married. Because after all, one could not buy a home if you were not married. Now, I bought a house in Corvallis in 1969. I was single. I had a good job and good credit and didn't think anything about restrictions on my ability to do so. I got a loan from State Savings and Loan to do this. I decided I was going to stay in Corvallis and was tired of renting, and I wanted a place for my dog. The purchase was completed with no problem. But for years afterwards, whenever I encountered the loan officer who had worked with me on the purchase, he would proclaim to all around that he had gone against all accepted rules in, quote, letting me buy the house. But we could all start remembering and sharing, and I hope we have time to do this. So, who should read this book? I think anyone under 30, especially young women, would find this most enlightening. For those of us over 30, I would recommend it as a wonderful way to look back at what happened in these past 50 years, to see where your own experiences and those of your friends might have been similar, better, or worse than those Collins describes. You might learn some things in our history that you're not aware of, and it would certainly bring back a lot of memories. I know it did for me. Collins concludes with a quote from Nora Ephron, who told Newsweek when she went to work there that she was could not be employed because women couldn't be writers. But she went on to write some of her era's best-selling books and most popular movies. And she said that when the women's, this is a quote from her, when women's movements began to fade, I used to do about 10 speeches a year, in part about how not enough had happened. But now, she says, I was completely wrong. It's a gigantic change. It's unbelievable what happened. It's shocking. It's amazing. And I just look back and think, you must not have been seeing something, because look at this thing. And as Collins says at the beginning of her book, then suddenly everything changed. The cherished convictions about women and what they could do were smashed in the lifetime of many of the women living today. It happened so fast that the revolution seemed to be over on either side before they could really find its way to the barricades. And although the transformation was imperfect and incomplete, it was still astonishing. A generation was born into a world where women were decreed to have too many household chores to permit them to serve on juries, and where a spokesman for NASA would say that any, quote, talk of a woman, American spacewoman, makes me sick to my stomach, end quote, would come of age in a society where female astronauts and judges are routine. Parents who hope for a child to carry on the family business, or for another doctor in the family, or for a kid to play ball with in the backyard on a summer night, no longer drooped with disappointment when the new baby turned out to be a girl. It was the liberation that countless generations of American women have been waiting for, whether they knew it or not, and it happened in our time. So, in an incident described at the very beginning of the book, Collins tells of a morning in the summer of 1960 when Lois Rabinowitz, wearing neatly pressed slacks and a blouse, had gone to a New York City court to pay a fine for her boss. She was sent home by that magistrate to put on a more appropriate outfit. And then at the very end of the book, Collins tells a story of Tahita Jenkins, a New York City bus driver, who was fired because she refused, for religious reasons, to wear slacks. So, American women have shattered the ancient traditions that deprived them of independence and power and the right to have adventures on their own, and done it so thoroughly that few women under 30 have any real concept that things have ever been any different. The feminist movement in the late 20th century created a new United States in which women ran for president, fought for their country, argued before the Supreme Court, performed heart surgery, directed movies, and flew into space. But it did not resolve the tensions of trying to raise children and hold down a job at the same time. Women demolished the sexual double standard and reared new generations of men who appreciated the concept of equal rights for both sexes, even if they did not always act on it. But women did not figure out how to keep marriage from crumbling into divorce, and they were not particularly successful in making their lovers grow into dependable husbands. They had not remade the world the way the revolutionaries had hoped, but they had created a world their female ancestor did not even have the opportunity to imagine, and they still wore silly impractical shoes. Thank you for listening. Any comments? Yes, back there.
It's really interesting that this issue of newsweek that you just showed us is the first effort of Tina Brown to just appoint.
Exactly. Yeah, she was being interviewed on NPR this morning too about that, and she has been an editor of a number of other magazines, but they hired her, and it's very obvious. And she has made this point that this is something she's going to have a lot more women. But there were some other women writers in the earlier one. Yes.
What was your response to the loan officer who let you buy your house?
Oh well, you know, at the time I bought it, you know, I just was buying my house. I didn't think. But then when he started doing this, I would say, Norm, what are you doing? Yeah. Yes, Mary Jane.
Helen seems to have not particularly gone into the area of women's health and the revolution. We thought we were moving in that area. But I want to remind people that it's still abound because just recently Congress has put through a law saying that Planned Parenthood could not receive any federal funds, and I think that's
yes. Mary Jane indicated that Collins did not spend I didn't mention a lot of what she dealt with in terms of women's health issues, and she does spend some time talking about what happened with Roe versus Wade and all the issues surrounding women's reproductive rights as women's health. And Mary Jane noted that this is continuing to be a problem, especially with the recent efforts to defund Planned Parenthood, for instance, which provides a lot more than it's not just abortion, it's not a minor part of what they do, but it's a lot of issues that help women with various kinds of health issues as well. Any other comments or experiences you'd like to share?
Would you please indicate that Mary Jane is a retired gynecologist?
Yes, Mary Jane is a retired gynecologist, yes. Dr. Mary Jane Gray. Yes.
One of the things that I was watching for in the book while I was reading it was a discussion of how humor was used back in the 70s to make light of the women's movement. And there were many times I would hear phrases like, I'm no women's liver, but, and I hate that phrase. And, you know, nobody would ever use the N-word like the L-word was used. And that was just one of the painful things I think that I had to deal with back when I was doing this.
Did you hear her comment about the... do we have that other microphone that we could take to people who want? Her comment was that she didn't find she had read the book. Yeah, she told me she was reading it. That the Collins didn't deal too much with the issue of what had happened with attempted humor and how that could many times be very hurtful, and that use the example of someone say, "Well, I'm no women's liver, but," then go on to the end. The fact that she made the comment that people might not use the N-word, but they'll use the L-word that could be just as hurtful to people.
And the
B-word, yes, right, yes. Other comments or experiences over here? Just a second. She's going to bring you a microphone so people can hear. Just put it right up to your mouth. Put it right up to your mouth.
Okay.
Good. Perfect.
In the late 60s, I was working for a police department in California, and the ladies in the office wanted to start wearing pantsuits, and they put up this thing, no, you're not allowed. So the girls staged a rebellion, and they came in and wore long skirts. And one of the girls was on probation because she was new, and they fired her, and everybody got censured. And within 2 weeks, a new memo came through that you were allowed to wear pantsuits as long as they were one thing, not slacks and a blazer, but they had to match.
Oh, dear. David.
Just very quickly, I appreciate your session today. It's brilliantly rendered and timely as could be, because I noticed that yesterday is International Women's Day. This
yes.
day, the very day
right.
afterwards is time, couldn't be timed better.
Right. Here. You know, and I don't think Corvallis did anything to celebrate International Women's Day. The campus might have done something. I know last year they did some things for Women's History Month. Here, Betty? No, right here. Just hold it.
Yeah. I remember one of my daughters coming home from school and slamming the door as she came in. She was furious because her counselor, who was a woman, had advised her against taking architecture as a goal. She didn't later on anyway, but she was so mad. And the woman said, "But you'll never get anywhere." And this was quite a few years ago.
Yeah, this would have been in the 70s.
At the same time, I was in library school, and we were studying. The library school at the U of O said that he insisted that we have a couple courses in computer science because he said the systems analysts were all men and the librarians were women, and he wanted us to be conversant with the terms of computers. This was before PCs or anything. But this girl who was so angry with the counselor is now a PhD and is teaching information technology in Monmouth.
Over here.
I thought people might be interested to know that when...
That's good.
So close. Okay. That when I started graduate school on a PhD program in 1969 in biology, that in all of the sciences on our campus, there was only one woman professor. And there was a woman, though. But she always wore a man's suit and necktie whenever she had to lecture. And she was in the geology department. And when she wanted to go on a field trip out of the country check out a site, she had to officially marry one of the men who was going, because married wives could go on trips that were sponsored by National Science Foundation, but single women could not. And then they'd come back and she'd officially get a divorce. And that's what it was like in the 60s.
Well, that reminds me of a situation when I was, it was probably about maybe, it was after I became the Dean of Women, and I got a call and wanted to know if I wanted to go on one of the hydrocraze cruises that the oceanography department was doing, where you got on the ship and you went out and stopped periodically, took water samples and brought them back, analyzed, turned around, and they came back. Well, that would sound like really interesting, so I said, sure. So I went along. Well, it turned out that even though, you did have to work a shift, you know, stand there and try to read the stuff with the ship going back and forth and chewing on your soda crackers so you don't get sick. But turned out that they had a couple other women students were going on the cruise, but there was an empty bed in the women's bunk room, and they couldn't have that empty. So you had to have another woman along. So, and I got to go on two different cruises because of that. And I've heard talk to other people who had similar experiences. Now, there are, of course, all kinds of women in oceanography and doing all sorts of things. Shirley?
On that subject, and John has just left. but I told him I was going to tell the story. He became chairman when we came back. I don't remember, but it was in the 60s. And we had our biggest argument, loudest argument ever about whether women should go out on the ship at all. And none had. And it was fierce. And he said it'll only lead to trouble. And sure enough, they finally relented, and a woman went out on a cruise. And there was an extramarital affair. Of course, it was all her fault. Now, John figured that it took two to tango. But things have changed, and things have changed with both of us. And I think, for the better.
Yeah. There are. It's interesting to look at the colleges at OSU now and the number of women who not only are on the faculties in many of the non-traditional, what had been non-traditional fields, but who are leaders, department heads and deans and so forth. But and I think also it's true that men have become much more aware of how the collaborative work can bring about even better research and better gains in what goes on. And it's not a matter of trying to denigrate men, but in terms of trying to have some equality in working together. Other experiences or anything you'd like to share here?
Well, I have a question about the International Women's Treaty that the U.S. hasn't signed.
Yeah.
Did she, Colin talk about
she,
that?
She doesn't. She doesn't mention that at all. Which and it's that's kind of interesting because they won't sign it, and actually Congress won't approve it. Is what it is, and any treaty has to. You know, she does spend some time in the International Women's Year Conference. You know, I found my pin that I from there. That, but she doesn't mention that. But it is Congress that just refused because they, same way that some states won't take the Equal Rights Amendment. Interestingly, one of the arguments that one of the women on this program on Sunday said, well, you know, there's nowhere in the Constitution that it mentions either men or women. You know, they don't use that word. So it just applies across the board. Well, I don't know whether that holds any water or not.
Lonnie Roberts gave a talk at ALL recently, mm-hmm. And the title of her talk was Are Women Human?
Yeah.
And the conclusion was no, legally we are not, because especially in the U.S. where we are not included in the Constitution. And cited Antony Scalia's, Antonia Scalia's interview, citing that we are not covered under the
mm-hmm. under the 14th Amendment. Yeah. 14th mm-hmm. Amendment. Right behind her was a person with her.
Just an added comment too, when you mentioned how that their family's passing on the occupation of
closer.
Being a doctor.
Closer.
Or a lawyer, and that, and I think the big piece, the big change is when there is a family where there are only daughters, and there's no one that can pass on that family name, and how gradually it is coming that the girls can take the mother's name mm-hmm. and pass that name on, and the boys can take the dad's name.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, there are some cultures where the children take the mother's name, not the father's name anyway. Back here.
If you look around the room here, you see a few bald-headed old guys, but not very many. But more remarkable is there are no young women. Hardly a one. Well,
they're working. Yeah.
Hey, I'm the father of a psychotherapist and a lawyer. My daughters, it's just a big yawn.
Mm-hmm.
They have no interest in this.
Yeah. Well, that's the point that she makes, is that people just don't.
Back to my question.
Oh.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
What do you think? Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Should is it a good thing?
Depends on whether there's something coming up in Congress.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Isn't it about the same thing as we need to know why we fought various kinds of wars to get sorts of why we had a civil rights movement and how that it wasn't always just like it is today? Yeah, over here. Okay.
The election that changed everything for American women. It really matters a lot what the younger generation thinks.
She said the book, Big Girls Don't Cry.
By Rebecca Traister.
Rebecca Traister's the author. The election that, what election?
The last one. Obama got elected.
Right.
There's a lot of humor out there that was directed at Hillary Clinton.
Yeah. Oh, you just can read all sorts of things, comments about clothing and everything else. Yes.
It would be interesting to note that there would be no male senators if there were not females.
Did you hear that? There would be no male senators if there were not females. Yeah, right back at the back.
But one of the things that the Mary Nosewick points out is that the number of men in the world far outnumbers women now, especially with the policy in Asia. They didn't even mention in Nosewick about how the female babies got thrown in the river. But there are so many males, so it's going to be an interesting future. I don't know whether I'm glad I'm not going to be here or I wish I were.
There's one comment back here. Back behind.
I just have a question. I look around the world at women who were where we are, maybe 20s, 30s, something last night about Guatemalan women who have 9 and 10 babies and can't get out of that. Is there any insight in this book about how this kind of movement can start helping women around the world? Where was the turning point? What sort of things need to happen so that it can happen for those other women?
She really doesn't address that to that extent. It's more of a historical look. But read this issue of Newsweek to answer that question, because there are women around the world in various countries who are trying to address these issues of how to help women to find businesses for themselves, women who are in domestic violence issues, or women who've been forced to marry at the age of 9. And this issue, I think, could give you some insights into that. Okay, Nancy, one more question over here.
I think it's important that young women and men understand the history. Many of us even do not realize that the woman's suffrage was proposed 40 times before it passed. Mm-hmm. 40 times. And I think a lot of young women take Title IX, their opportunities, their wage equality for granted. Mm-hmm. I don't think they should.
Yeah. Last question over here.
Mine's a personal story from probably early 70s. My father was a professor of history, and he was telling about this brilliant male graduate student he had who was about to take a year off from working on his thesis so that he would do the childcare, and his wife would have a chance to work on her thesis. And I thought this was wonderful. My father thought it was terrible that this promising young male student was going to take a year off. It would put his career, his hiring, it would just damage him so much. And I argued back about it. And he never actually gave in, but he sort of went, "Prof." And I think I probably made some difference in his thinking.
Well, thank you very much.
He's a stubborn old guy.
Thank you all very much.